listeners. I'm Sam with Below the Radar, a knowledge democracy podcast. Below the Radar is recorded on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. On this episode of Below the Radar, our host, Amjo Hall, is joined by Glenn Clark, who is formerly Premier of British Columbia, as well as President and Chief Operating Officer of the Jim Patterson Group in Vancouver. Glenn discusses his political career, from his time in labour movements to the Legislative Assembly, and further on to how he exited politics and got into working with the corporate titan Jim Patterson. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, welcome to Below the Radar. Delighted that you could join us again this week. We have a very special guest here right in our 312 Main studios. We have Glenn Clark. Welcome, Glenn.
Great. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, why don't we start with you introducing yourself a little bit?
Well, I'm Glenn Clark. I think some people know who I am anyway. I grew up in East Vancouver and I'm still living there.
Well, I think some people would say you've had a pretty legendary BC life, from union organizer to premier to corporate leader. And now recently, I mean, you don't seem like the retirement type, but officially that's there. I'm wondering, I think for a number of people or listeners, they might not have been around BC in the 90s when you were premier.
Are you saying I'm old, Am?
No, not at all. I mean, I was around. I'm old. You're not old. You're younger than Joe Biden. You're younger than Joe Biden, Glenn.
As everybody else is.
Yeah. I'm wondering if we can maybe start with you. You know, before you got your entry into politics as a young person, becoming politically aware at university, how you kind of started to get interested in politics. I'm around a lot of people who are, you know, thinking about doing various types of social change work or contributing back in various ways, and politics might be one stream that people go through. I'm around a lot of students at SFU and other places, but take us back to Glenn as a student.
Well, first of all, my dad was a business agent for the Painters Union. And so, and from Scotland, my mother's from Scotland. And so very political in terms of labor, right? Labor supporter. And so I think as a young child, I dropped leaflets for COPE in Vancouver, which and I also did some work for the NDP. My parents, or my dad made me, if you will. He'd agree to drop leaflets, and then I would, or the kids would do it. I have three sisters. We grew up in on Renfrew Street. And so I started early on active in a political family, if you will, with a labor perspective. My father was not necessarily as much an NDP supporter as he was a labor supporter. So he wasn't a big fan of the 1974 NDP government sending people back to work and stuff. He was a little bit more militant than that. And so as I went to university on my own, if you will, after sort of that indoctrination, if you will, and doing leaflets, you know, I just found that everything I learned in university reinforced the correctness of my father's view by and large. And so got active in the NDP, both in federally Vancouver Kingsway and provincially Vancouver East. And there was a bunch of us around the same age group, and we had a lot of fun. And Bob Williams was the MLA for a while and came back to becoming the MLA. And Bob was very supportive and interesting intellectually for those of us who are interested. So I didn't always agree with Bob, but he was provocative and interesting. And so the meetings in East Vancouver, which you don't see, I think, as much today, there's a lot of policy discussion, substantive policy discussion. And then we would all, you know, go for a beer after every meeting. And so we were quite a big crowd of us, actually. And that's how I got, you know, as active in East Van. And then when I was going to university, and partly through the NDP, I got a summer job as an iron worker working in a steel fabrication shop out in Richmond. And then the union offered me a job helping to organize. So I was a union organizer for a while I was doing my master's in planning. And my master's, that's why it took 5 years to do my master's, did 2 years of program work, 2 years of coursework, if you will. And then I worked as a union organizer for a couple of years. And then I finally finished my thesis and got my degree.
Now, Bob's been a guest on our show. Bob's over 90 now, and wondering if you can talk a little bit about the Bob Williams of that period that you worked for. I mean, he's quite a legend in his own right.
Certainly. And, you know, well, Bob has, you know, more ideas in his pinky than I'll ever have in my lifetime, probably. You know, he just generates a lot of interesting ideas. You know, some of them, I think, probably don't work. Some of them are really, well, most of them are visionary in some respects, but they're always thought-provoking. Here's what I really like about Bob Williams. Bob Williams came from the same part of town as me. And one of the things he sort of taught you, either by example or in reality, was that you didn't have to take a back seat to anybody. So just because you have money, just because you're a business person, does not make you smarter. And I still think today, a lot of people on the left don't really understand that concept. They think that when it comes to business, you know, oh, these business people are smarter. Or when it, you know, if they've got this much money, they must be smart. At least subconsciously, they think that. And whereas Bob had that, maybe you could call it arrogance, but he had the temerity to say, no, people from lower income neighborhoods are just as smart, maybe smarter than all these other people. And so that was a very big influence on people like me because, you know, we'd come from a pretty low income background. And it's easy to be intimidated by people with money or business people or people who are viewed as successful. And the truth is, there's just no reason to be intimidated. They're not any smarter. In many cases, I can name lots of longshoremen who are a lot smarter than some captains of industry. So I think Bob really gave us that sense of confidence that we could make a difference. And it didn't matter where we started in terms of our life.
Now, when you first got elected into opposition in 86, as a relative young person, I mean, that would take us back to that time period a little bit. Bill Bennett had been in Operation Solidarity in 83, Expo 86 coming through. Bob Skelly was the leader of the NDP in that election, a very tight election that went back and forth. Yeah, briefly, that's right. But you got elected with a bunch of, you know, young Artika Mosahoda, Dan Miller, a bunch of people who really made it, like you guys made hay in opposition. It seemed like you were also having a really great time doing it.
We did have a good time doing it. Again, Bob provided a lot of leadership there because, again, in the legislature, you need to have a strong sense of ideology, I think, to be effective in politics, right or left, right? Because some people get into politics because they want to be nice people and they want to participate and contribute. And, you know, I don't take anything away from that. But it's such a conservative, you know, the status quo is such a powerful influence in everything that if you really want to make change, you have to really be confident and assert your view. And it helps to have a healthy dislike for those in power. And so when we were in opposition, you know, we weren't going to sit around and wait for decorum. We weren't going to sit around and wait for, you know, 20 years. We weren't happy being in opposition. We wanted to beat the government. We wanted to defeat the government. And we worked extremely hard and we were, I'd say, fearless about trying to go about doing it. And some of the older guys have been in opposition for a while, older people, and they were very capable people, but they were a bit more laid back than we were. We were impatient to try to make change. So I think we had an impact in the world. Different time, you know, the media played a bigger role, I think, the mainstream media. And so, you know, we catered to that in a way to try to get attention out, you know. I remember once talking to Grace McInnes. I was going way back. I did a fourth year political economy course. I did an interview. The whole course was me just doing an interview with Grace McInnes in her elderly years. And she said something really interesting, which was actually kind of silly, but in hindsight, I think at the time, quite perceptive. She said, too many politicians come back to their constituency. They go to Ottawa and then they come back all the time. And it's exhausting. She said, you do make more impact getting on television and making a difference than you will coming back and meeting with three or four people. And that sounds almost elitist in a way, right? But I think it was actually quite perceptive, especially we're talking now in the 60s, right? And the 70s. And so she basically said, look, use the medium to get your message out and really try hard to sort of popularize issues using popular media. And don't think because you're a community activist and just, you know, you're down and fighting in the trenches, that that will change the world. It's important to do that. But if you're elected, you really need to find a way to popularize progressive views. And so it's an unlikely source probably to come from that inspiration, but I really think she's right, you know, that you need the community activism, but to win And again, the ultimate goal of politics is to actually win and make change. And to win, you need to convince the broader public of your progressive vision for the province or the country. And the best way to do that is to communicate through mass media.
In that period in the late 80s, early 90s, eventually Harcourt became leader and came in through the election. But that was such a strange, you know, the Wim Vandersam years were pretty insane in a bunch of ways. Even by contemporary standards, the kind of social conservatism, the issues around abortion that kind of came forward as well that were sort of pushed back. But since there'll be a lot of poli-sci and history students listening to this, I'm wondering if you can share anything about that, what you remember a significant around the 1991 election, change of government, a change of the guard, change in generations in a way.
Well, actually, remember in 1991, Bill Vandersam had stepped down. And Bill Vandersam was a much better politician than I think people realize. Better in a populist way. I remember when he first got elected, just to tell you a few stories. He first got elected, there was somebody complaining about BC Hydro working outside their house. He was on the radio and someone phoned in and said, look, I got this BC Hydro and they're pounding in my front street every day. I can't, and I'm a graveyard shift. I can't sleep. This is just a normal working class person phoning in. And he said, okay, I'll fix that. And he did. And people said, oh, how outrageous that he would intervene in BC Hydro to make life better for that one person. That doesn't make any sense. And I always thought, boy, that was kind of magic to that, right? Like he was not afraid to use power to help people. Now, he might not agree with his version of help, right? But he, there's a small example. I'll give you one other example. There was a big First Nations protest in the rotunda, no, outside the legislature. A big, in those days, you know, maybe those 200 First Nations people there and they were chanting outside the lawns, outside the legislature. And it was after hours and the media had gone home and they were chanting. And I went out there as an opposition member and just stood there kind of in solidarity with them. And suddenly I saw the Premier of British Columbia, Bill Vandersam, leave his office by himself, no staff. And he walked all the way over. And I thought, my God, you know, people are really angry. I thought this might be a confrontation, an altercation. And he walked right into the middle of the First Nations crowd. And he said, who's the leader here? You know, who? And they said, there's two or three people. He said, well, why don't you come with me? And he took them into his office and they sat there for 2 hours, had a meeting. And of course the demonstration, he did that without TV cameras there. He did that at some, you know, which is unusual, you know, in a lot of ways. And now, did he solve the problem? No. Did he do anything? Frankly, no. But on that file, probably not. But he was fearless about people. He had a real sense of people and a very good politician. What got him in trouble only really was the social issues. He felt so strongly about, you know, the abortion question as a very almost fundamentalist Catholic. He really struggled with, or not struggled with, he really has had strong views on that. I mean, he had other issues, you know, remember, that were with, you know, money in his business, getting mixed up and all that stuff. But what got him in trouble with the mainstream public was his minority view on some of these social issues. And ultimately, he stepped down over, as you know, a scandal. But frankly, I would have been much more afraid of him running than what happened, because he stepped down and then the Social Credit Party was kind of a mess. And they elected a woman named Rita Johnson who ran, and she was not that strong a candidate, as it turned out. And actually quite a very strong and very good cabinet minister, actually, but not a very good leader at the time. And of course, the Liberals came up. And Mike Harcourt, who had been, you know, a successful City of Vancouver mayor, and I think very successful for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which was he was really confident in his skin, you know, like he was comfortable being a leader as he was in the city, and he was comfortable in a general sense running for the NDP. So I think, of course, we didn't win by very much, but, you know, Mike, you know, helped to sort of mainstream the NDP. Bill Vandersam helped to sort of marginalize the Social Credit Party on social issues. And between the two of them, we had a nice victory.
Now, you had a number of senior cabinet positions in the Harcourt government. Wondering if you can speak to the parts that you remember, the parts that you're proud of.
I'm proud of all of it pretty well. But I got elected at 28 And then I was Minister of Finance at 32. And I raised taxes, as you probably know, on more than anybody had ever raised taxes on the wealthy. I got in a bit of trouble by putting a tax on houses over $1 million, which, you know, I guess by today's standards would be probably like about $2 or $3 million houses. So, and there was a big protest at Oak Ridge Shopping Center, and 10,000 people came out to protest.
Like a tax revolt.
Yeah, my tax. And I said something which wasn't very smart. I said, well, just think how many people would have been there if they had valet parking. And so I got in a lot of trouble for that. Although I was very proud, they did the media did a man in the street kind of interview in my constituency, and they interviewed five people, and all five of them supported me. They just said, you know what, go sell some jewelry if you can't pay for it or something, was one guy said. So my car court felt the heat, as the media, of course, and the establishment were just furious at that version of attacks. And so he asked me to climb down from it, which I did. And then I think at the first opportunity, he wanted to move me out of finance, which is his prerogative. At the time, it's interesting because I'd started a bunch of stuff outside the mainstream, right? I did the bank at Maine and Hastings with Jim Green. I hired Jim Green, Stephen Leary, a bunch of people to work on some stuff. I was finance minister, remember? So I was trying to find a finance angle and try to make a difference. And I remember when they were talking about shuffling him out of finance, I was sort of negotiating with the premier's office as to what position to take. And Jim Green and I were actually just, we had an office down over here, and we were sort of going back and forth on what to ask for. And as it turned out, it was really a good decision for me, actually, because I ended up being economic development. I had responsibility for BC Transit, BC Ferries, BC Hydro, all capital construction for the government, and economic development. And turns out that was a lot more fun than being finance minister in the end. And I had a good time. And I managed to keep, I kept the Downtown East Side, the Jim Green unit, the community agreement. We created Blade Runners at that time and a few other programs, mostly under the leadership of Jim Green, frankly, with my sponsorship, if you will, inside government. And then we worked on the Four Pillars, the original Four Pillars project, which we just started to implement just as I was, and with Jenny Kwan was an MLA at the time, and just as I was becoming premier.
In that Harcourt period, there was a lot of land use planning that was going on, and taking a look at some of the kind of bigger projects. As a planner yourself, like some of the kind of bigger policy agendas that got moved during that time.
Well, the big agenda was when we got elected, we wanted to double the parkland of the province. So we wanted to do what the United Nations, you know, Gro Harlem Brundtland said, that we should try to preserve. I think it was, I don't know what her target was, but our target was 12%. And the 6% of the province was covered by parks. So we wanted to double the parkland. And some of that's not that hard in a giant province with a lot of rocks and mountains. What we tried to do was establish these tables where we could negotiate with industry and the communities and environmentalists, and to really try to drive this land use planning process. And Bob was involved in that. Bob Williams, by the way, early days in terms of design and how we went about doing it. And I think it was a huge success, frankly, because we doubled the amount of parkland. We managed to get a lot of consensus in a lot of areas, some of which were really challenging, some of which were relatively easy. And then when I was premier, we just sort of kind of concluded that process. I managed to get involved in a bunch of stuff, including the Musquecucica, which is the biggest park, about the size of Switzerland and North one. But, you know, we'd made a lot of compromises. For example, we allowed the guide outfitters to stay and hunt in the park, in what would be the park. We allowed the jet boats to continue to use the rivers because local people wanted it. We allowed horizontal drilling. It was the first time to allow, we didn't allow any, obviously, exploitation of minerals or natural gas in the park or forestry, but we did allow some horizontal drilling to tap into natural resources underneath the park, which is actually happening. And of course, we created protected areas and a park. It was a bit of a broader stretch, but it was a very interesting process, very challenging in lots of parts of BC, but we really managed to make progress. You know, I've never been a huge supporter of process, but actually this is where the process really, and this, you know, certainly Mike Harcourt's style, but also where the process really benefited, because it really forced people to make trade-offs to advance the cause of land preservation, conservation. I think something the current government could learn from, actually.
You know, a lot of people who get into the political side, they don't necessarily know the civil service side or how you make change in a governmental context, working with deputy ministers and others along. So that interplay between bureaucracy and politics. And wondering if you could just speak to that dynamic. These are big bureaucratic institutions. They're slow moving. They have their own processes and logic. And for a political animal such as yourself, it'll seem like this thing is getting in my way. And so how do you think around that, or how do you still figure out a way to make that change?
Well, first of all, we, unlike the current government, you know, we changed the number of the deputies. So we brought in more sympathetic deputies, which I think is absolutely number one most important thing you should do if you're trying to make change, because the system is inherently conservative. And again, the challenge with the bureaucracy is not that they're not bad people or they're left or right. They're basically busy working extremely hard on existing programs, which means almost by definition, the defenders of the status quo. You know, if you're in the social services side and you're giving out social service programs, you know, your job is, if you will, to administer that program, not to think of innovative or creative ways to do it. So I found very little, like almost none, but very little really creative, interesting proposals coming up from the sort of bowels of the bureaucracy. And again, it wasn't necessarily the bureaucrats didn't have ideas. It's just that they're not encouraged to, and they're busy, and they have lives, and so they're busy running and administering the existing programs. So that's why, in our case, we had the Crown Corporation Secretariat, we had this central agency, Bob Williams was involved in that, we had a bunch of really smart people involved in that, progressive people that we brought into it, to really sort of take the innovation, if you will, away from the bureaucracy directly, and create another arm of the bureaucracy that was thinking of new ideas. And some of them, you know, most of them were quite successful. Some of them didn't work. But again, you know, if you think about it, this is just one example. So we did the commuter rail, or I was involved in doing commuter rail from Vancouver to Mission. Well, that wasn't on anybody's radar. That certainly wasn't TransLink or anybody or the predecessor to TransLink. Nobody, and people didn't think it could be done. And, you know, we managed to just do it, right? And we did a bunch of stuff like that. So, the bureaucracy is not a place that's easy for innovation. There might be micro innovation, I think, inside the system. But I think as an entity, it's very hard. But by the way, in the private sector, same way, big, giant bureaucracies, private sector bureaucracies, you know, banks and these places, they're not exactly, you know, brimming with innovation either. So it's, you know, you need to set up, I think, dedicated sort of innovation teams that are not from this, or either from the system, but not with line responsibility, to really think through how to go ahead about these things. We were really, I think, lucky or smart. You know, we brought in some really good thinkers, Doug MacArthur and some other people from other governments, to think about how to set up these processes, because we also set up the treaty process, right, which was another huge undertaking with Andrew Petter and very involved in that. So all Gary Waters, all these people we brought in and combined with the politicians to try to design processes to get to where we wanted to see it go, right? And to try, I think to try, the trick is to try not to be as prescriptive about where you want to go as much as, you know, to be flexible about where you can, how you can get there. And I think, you know, we did a pretty good job on that. Again, lots of failures, I'm sure, but it was an exciting time for that. And we'd made lots of change. And we managed to, broadly speaking, I think, maintain a fair amount of consensus in doing so. I mean, if you were in a mining company, you weren't going to be happy with the government. If you're a forester, you probably weren't happy. If you were any of the industrial users of the land base, you might not be happy, because we were driving for big creation of parkland, if you will, or conservation areas. And so in a way, you're inherently, you know, there's an inherent conflict of interest between the two. So that wasn't easy, but we managed to get some uneasy, if you will, agreements in most places of the province with most people.
I want to talk a little bit about the 96 election, which in BC is it's a legendary one, because it was so close. It was a come from behind. It really could have gone either way. The NDP was probably somewhere in the 20s in the polls, I think, when you first came in as leader. But whenever you can sort of walk us through that period, like, first of all, you coming in to become leader post Harcourt, and then there was the few month period before the election. I was up in Williams Lake that summer after university. I was helping out on David Zernholt's campaign. It was like a razor thin. He barely got through, but yeah. It was such a, it's a very interesting one for students, I think, in particular.
Yeah, we were, I think, I don't know, 20, 25 points behind when I took over. But here is my fundamental belief. I believed that the Mike Harker government had done a lot of good things and was and shouldn't have been unpopular. It, you know, it wasn't, it, the economy wasn't bad. We'd accomplished a lot. And so why was it the public had lost confidence in the government according to the polls? And my thought was that we just hadn't done a good job of reconnecting. Because what happens with incumbent governments, you see this now, particularly with the federal Liberal government, right? They get kind of inured. They get detached from the public, right? You know, the Trudeau goes on this fancy vacation paid for by some wealthy guy, you know, without thinking that most people can't go to vacation at all, let alone go to some fancy resort. That's out of touch. And I think we had kind of lost touch with people. We're too busy sort of trying to run the government and do, you know, do good things that we got kind of bureaucratic. So I felt strongly that if we reconnected with people, fundamentally, they weren't that unhappy with the government. We just needed to show that we were reconnecting. So as you probably remember at the time, I froze tuition fees, for example, which I don't know if it's public, probably not public knowledge, but the overwhelming majority of cabinet was against that. And they were against it because they thought it was, they preferred the notion of high tuition fees and grants for poor people. That was the debate, I guess. And I felt strongly that tuition fees were a symbol and an impediment to getting access to both any post-secondary education if you're from a poor background. I know for sure in my case, I would never have gone to university if it hadn't been for the ease of access that took place for me in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s, where university access was easier. So I froze tuition fees on post-secondary institutions. I froze BC Hydro rates. I froze ICBC rates. And I remember at the time freezing ICBC rates, the board, the NDP board of directors of ICBC was going to resign over it. And I always felt, I felt strongly that if you have a crown corporation, you know, it has to be seen differently than a private corporation. Otherwise, why have it? I mean, you might as well just privatize it. So I always really wanted to use the crowns to try to make a difference. So I did a series of initiatives like that, which showed people that A, there was a new person in charge. B, we weren't doing anything. It wasn't particularly radical, but it was reconnecting with working class voters in British Columbia. And we did a whole bunch of other stuff too. And I, you know, a lot of stuff, but we managed to sort of turn the momentum. And then of course I polarized the electorate and I polarized it in a way that we've not seen before in Canada, which by the way, made it harder to govern after we won. But, you know, I ran explicitly in favor of a tax increase on the wealthy. And so I just made it an us versus them. You know, the slogan was on your side. We ran it hard against the wealthy people. And I made one thing, if I were in hindsight, which I'd criticize myself for, I actually named specific business leaders that we were going to tax more because they had public information what they made. And that was a bit more, too much of an ad hominem attack on my part. I shouldn't have done that, I think, in hindsight. At the time, it was quite lots of fun. And so we quite deliberately set about A, reconnecting with our voters and polarizing the electorate so that people knew, as they say, you don't have to be the best in politics, you just have to be better than the other guy. And the other guy, I felt strongly, wasn't very good, or at least wasn't anything I would support. And so that was the key. We did really well. I think we would have won relatively handily, except for Gordon Wilson, who ran for the Liberal Party, who I didn't think he ran a particularly effective campaign, but I think he did a broadcast, he paid advertising 3 days before the election campaign started. And it was a professional 30-minute show on television that he bought. They didn't do much advertising. They just one big kind of piece. And he managed to peel off about 5 or 6% of the vote. And it pretty well all came from us, from the NDP. And I think if he hadn't have done that, if we had a few more days, we might have lost, actually, because he really took some votes away from us, which is why I worked hard to try to convince him to cross the floor at one point.
Yeah, so you came in a very polarizing time, and the media was quite critical of the NDP. It was also, I think, a different time around running deficits and those types of things was very present. But there was also some groundbreaking legislation. The Nishka Agreement happened during that time period. But I wonder if you can speak a little bit to the kinds of things that got done.
Yeah, well, the Nisga Treaty, of course, is a great legacy. I'm disappointed that we haven't seen many more. It was Tuason, I guess, but we haven't. Because I really thought, I liked the treaty approach because I wanted to, so I thought it would make a difference, but I also thought from the non-Aboriginal point of view, it was a settlement, right? As opposed to more incrementality that we've seen since then, which a lot of which has really made a difference, and including UNDRIP and everything. Remember, this was a different time, I guess, right? So that's not a criticism at all of what's happening now, but at the time, I was hoping this would be a template that we could roll through. But we worked hard on that. It was the first, you know, modern treaty since, I think, 1858, I think, actually. So we managed to make a difference there. I think we did a number of things that I, you know, was very proud of, some of which were rolled back by the government. But, you know, I abolished tuition fees for people who want to go back and get a high school education. That was one of my most moving announcements, actually, because the people who were either in college getting their high school education, these were really disadvantaged people who were going back trying to make a difference, and they were being charged tuition fees. So when we abolished that, it was a very powerful and positive thing to do for that cohort of people, and so that was fun. But we did lots of stuff. We did, as we said, commuter rail. We did the SkyTrain down Lougheed Highway. You know, we made a difference on parks. We did forest renewal. We did fisheries renewal, trying to put money back into the resource to try to keep resource jobs at the same time we were preserving, you know, parkland. So yeah, we did a lot of healthcare innovation. Some worked, some didn't. We really were a pretty, I would say it's hard to describe our government, the government I was part of, as not being an activist government. We were very active.
Of course, in politics and that kind of public life, you have your good days and your popular moments becoming leader, but you yeah. definitely saw the other side of that, which is a matter of public record, sure, from sure. the fast ferries to, you know, charges, all the other, the criminal charges, all of that stuff, to being like quite hated. Yeah. In fact, probably the most hated person at that moment in BC for a period of time.
I'm sure.
But reflecting back on it now from this vantage point, when you reflect back on that time now, what do you sort of think about, like, the broadly the spectacle of media and politics and the kind of scrutiny that people in public life go through?
The challenge at the time, I think, and this is a kind of a terrible lesson to learn, I think, or not a positive lesson, but when you run against the wealthy and you run explicitly against the wealthy and you're not supposed to win and you win, and then, you know, some people, which I won't name, you know, wouldn't even shake my hand. They were so hostile. So when you take the business community and almost universally have this incredible hostility, it's harder to govern. And what happened was, of course, we had a bit of a recession come in and we had running a deficit. And so you just felt the weight of the establishment, you know, just grinding away, trying to defeat you, really, doing anything they could to defeat you. They would be, you know, cheering for a bad economy so they could throw the guys out, right? There was the days before finance reform, so millions and millions of dollars poured into the opposition to try to defeat me and the NDP government. So that made it was very challenging. And that's the lesson, and I guess a further lesson is, you know, you need grassroots support, right? What happens when you're in government, at least when we were there, is we took a lot of activists, you know, and we put them right in the government. But what we didn't have then was an extra parliamentary interest groups advocating for the government. You know, we brought everybody inside the government. So we didn't have as much, I think we didn't do a very good job of nurturing grassroots activism and support for the government's objectives, like working with the grassroots in a way. So that left you vulnerable to the media and the money and the establishment. Because to fight that, you need people. And then when you start losing the people, you lose popular support, which governments do, and you make some difficult decisions and you're less popular, it becomes a kind of a cascading effect. It becomes very challenging to fight back. You have the power of the state, which is the good news, and you can actually make a difference in people's lives. And we continue to try to do that right up until we were defeated. You know, we really worked hard at trying to ignore all the noise and try to make a difference in people's lives. But fundamentally, we lost the debate, if you will. We lost the room, as they'd say in a sports analogy.
Now, after finishing your term, you were a backbench MLA for a while. I'm wondering how you spent your time there, because I want to get into talking about your rise up the corporate ladder after that. So,
well, when I stepped down as premier, and I had eight criminal charges were about to be leveled against me, but I actually needed a job, right? Because I got elected young and I had a family and I had a mortgage to pay. So I stayed as a backbencher. I thought I was only going to stay for a few months because I assumed that the government would call an election. And Mr. Dosanjh didn't call an election. He ran the string out for a whole year. So I was a backbench government member for about a year. But I had some fun. You know, I brought in some private members' bills to end the grizzly bear hunt, which was a bit controversial at the time. I brought in a private members' bill, which, of course, didn't go anywhere, but I brought it in. I brought in a private members' bill to allow people to have pets in their apartments because I think, personally, this is just my view, you know, if you're a backbench member of the government, you know, it doesn't mean you have to shut up and stick your hand up whenever the government wants you to. Obviously, your parliamentary system, you're going to support the government. But I think there's a bit of latitude to actually speak. And I don't hear as much of that anymore. But it didn't bother me to speak on issues. They would get mad at me because they wanted me to go away probably. But I even asked them questions in question period, which you're allowed to do. But, you know, you could weigh in on issues. So I did that for a while. I started, of course, looking for a job right away, and I didn't get any offers from anybody except for Jane.
Your popularity.
Yeah, but including on the left, right? There was not exactly anybody in the trade union movement or anybody who would give me a job. Now, I wasn't overly fearful of that. I figured, you know, I'll just get a job like a normal person. You know, just it's not like I was looking for a high paying job. I just wanted a job. So anyway, Jimmy Pattison phoned me, and that was really organized by Dave Barrett. People don't know. I don't know if that's ever been public, but so Dave Barrett phoned me, and I said, look, I need a job. And so Dave phoned Jimmy, and then Jimmy phoned me and said, I hear you need a job, and said, yeah. So then I came downtown, and he gave me a job.
Yeah, and your first one. So it's interesting, is that the business community was very hostile towards you, and all of a sudden now you're working for one of the sort of titans of BC industry. Which you were at the sign shop first?
Yeah, so Jimmy gave me a job that wasn't senior management. It wasn't really even middle management. I was the branch manager of a relatively small company, the electric sign company, and they had about 10 employees. And I was, of course, then I had the trial. My trial was 8 months long, roughly. And so, the system is kind of crazy. You know, they only work for a few hours a day and they take time off and calendars. But the whole length of it was about 8 months. The actual wasn't every day or anything. But so when it was on in the courthouse, you know, I would try to go to the office at around 6:30 or 6 in the morning. And then about 8:30, I'd have to go down to the courthouse. Then I'd do a few hours in court. And then I'd come back to the office and work till late at night. And I worked on Saturdays as well. Yeah, it was good for me. Jimmy was great for me because he would also come in sometimes on Saturdays. So I had to learn, you know, what it was to be in business and how it worked and how the system worked. And it was really great for me. It was fun. I actually enjoyed it. And he ended up making me vice president. After I won the case, I became vice president of the sign company for Western Canada. And then he made me president of a different company after that, which I didn't want to do because I really felt good about the sign company. I was just making changes and we were having fun. And so he moved me to another operation. And then ultimately, then he became vice president of the whole group and then had these companies reporting to me and then president of the group and then chief operating officer for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years.
Coming from your background as a former union organizer working inside of politics at very senior levels to step into a business context, there's some things that translate, I suppose, and there's probably some things that you had to learn completely new.
Sure. I think, well, what translates is it's all about people, right? It's the same. We're all in the business of people. So leadership and people. And I think good politicians, in my view, they learn the details of a file, say. They really have to master the details of the file, but then they have to step back from that and paint the bigger picture of where you're going and a vision of where you're going, right? So you have to do both. Like vision without actually understanding the details of the problem is a problem, and understanding the details is not sufficient to show leadership. And in business, it's the same way, right? If you just understand the details, that's what you might call management. But if you understand the details and then you can put it in a context that people can understand and a vision that people can understand, then that's more a leadership role. So I think that part translates quite well. In business, is simpler than government, right? Government, you're in a way, you're management, right? It's when you're in government and you're a cabinet minister, you're running. I say that advisedly because you're not, but you're at least you're the titular head of a big organization that's delivering programs or services. And so you do have a lot of the same response. It's similar to running a business in that respect only, that there's a bunch of people that need, you know, the direction and where they're going. In business, it's simpler because the rules are clear. You have to make money. If you don't make money, you go out of business. If you're in business, you have to make money. How do you make money? You have to raise revenue or cut costs or both. And it's kind of simple rule. It's a bit Darwinian, but that's just the reality. In a market-based capitalist economy, you just run it and you have to make money. So even if you have to fire people, which is horrible, there's a reason for it usually, because you need to make money. you don't have any options. Whereas in government, there's usually multi-layered. That's the fun of government, but it's also everything is multi-layered. So if you have a crown corporation, should the crown corporation also be a better employer? Like, for example, we were working on a bunch of projects. We created Blade Runners to try to say, okay, well, we're going to spend this money on this infrastructure. How can we use that idea and the spending on infrastructure to create more jobs for disadvantaged people? Well, they need a very specific program that can help do that. How can we get more? Can we use this government spending on this initiative to create more apprenticeships? We did the Island Highway, which was a big project that I was very proud of, that I was involved with. And during that, we had more apprentices working than any government project in history. We had more women working, more First Nations people working than any government project in history. And we did it consciously and deliberately to try to leave a legacy. So the goal was to build the highway. If you're a business, that would be your only goal. But in government, you try to say, okay, well, can we use that to accomplish other social goals at the same time? And so it's much more complex. And of course, the other thing in government is there's often no right answer. Like literally no right answer. Gee, if we do this, this is horrible. If we do this, this is also horrible. We have to do one or the other, which one is least horrible or which one is least offensive. And so you're always making decisions that might not be optimum decisions. You're trying to, of course, make optimum decisions, but there's no obvious right answer. In business, there often is an obvious right answer. You might not like it, but it's obvious.
A couple more questions on the Pattison period. One, I heard this story that when Jimmy first hired you, that people were so grumpy, they ripped up their Save on Foods loyalty cards and he phoned them up. And my second question is just, any stories around companies that you were involved in turning around and ideas that you have around that?
Well, yeah, 400 people resigned, as I recall, from Save on Foods loyalty cards. 400 people, because they're so angry at Jimmy hiring me, even in a junior role. And Jimmy phoned them all. And he did not, I don't know if any of your listeners ever canvassed or anything else, but 400 people is a lot of people to call. Like, call 10 people. That's a lot of people. So Jimmy, I think no matter where he was in the world, he would just phone 10 or 15 people every night until he got through to everybody. And he managed to convince, I believe, all of them to rejoin. And so, he went out of his way to help. And he also, obviously it was his business as well, and he was defending, but he did as terrific. There's lots of examples. At any given time, Jimmy has a lot of companies. At any given time, one or two of them is not doing well. And that's the nature of this market economy we have. So, sometimes if the business is not doing well because of a secular concern, if I can put it that way, then that's more difficult. Then maybe you sell it or close it or something, because it's got the market itself is not big enough to justify it, or the market's changed. Bell closing all those radio stations. I'm not defending Bell particularly, but there's a secular change. People aren't listening to radio stations like they were before, and they're not as effective. So they chose to close them. And clearly their first option would be to sell them. Clearly there was no buyer, so they end up closing them. Usually a leadership issue, right? And it's different leaders for different times, right? Sometimes you need a leader who's a cost cutter, because the for whatever reason, it's very competitive. It's a tough environment. You have to make sure you're just as lean as you possibly can. See, that's an accountant kind of mindset to try to drive costs out of your business. Other times you need a leader who's kind of a wartime general who's going to say, okay, we're going to go and take everybody on. We're going to grow this business. And that means we have to take market away from other people. So I think in Jimmy's world, you know, he's very smart about that, is certain times you need a certain type of leaders and other times you need other types of leaders, right? And it's probably true in all walks of life.
I was going to talk just a little bit around the pandemic period, the challenges you might have encountered in business, because I guess in some ways we're still lingering outside of that time period, a lot of lingering challenges that come out of that. But what are some of the things that you faced during that period?
Really interesting. I mean, first of all, it was horrible personally, as you can imagine, because in my role as the chief operating officer of the Jim Pattison Group, we had all these divisions with their own management. I wasn't running the companies directly, but they were sort of reporting to me. I couldn't travel. And I really, really, and again, something I probably learned more from Jimmy, but, you know, Jimmy would visit every company or every groups of companies every quarter. So, and we would never make them come to Vancouver. We would go there, wherever there was. And so for a period of time, we couldn't do that. And so that was just, so, you know, they used to, you know, some people call it management by walking around. But when you go to a factory and you walk around with the local management, you get a pretty good feel for, well, are the people happy? Do they respect the leadership? Is there any problems? And if there's problems, people will either tell you or signal you in some way, right? But if you're doing it on a Zoom call, you're not interacting with the people on the shop floor, and that's really hard. And so some companies, at least from my point of view as a sort of senior person in the office, I felt less connected to the companies than I would normally be or like to be. But the other thing that was so weird about the pandemic, which we're still living with today, is how weird the unintended consequences of various actions, right? For example, the car business has never been this good, the automobile business. Now, I would have thought car business, oh, maybe that'll go slow down. People are moving to electric cars. There's less parts in electric cars. The business model may have to change. Well, who would have predicted, at least I wouldn't have predicted that, you know, there's these mass shortages of parts. Nobody's making cars. So the price of cars goes sky high. The margin goes up because there's a shortage of people. So the business is extremely profitable. And this is not the Jim Pattison Group. Everybody in the car business is the most profitable probably in history. All car businesses, because of the consequences of, you know, shutting factories down for a couple of years and then a shortage of used cars. This is the worst time for your listeners. If you can help it, don't buy a car or a used car today, because the prices are really high relative to history because there's been this shortage of supply. Other businesses, the grocery business for us was quite good, and I think true for full service groceries. Your listeners might understand this, but I didn't at the time realize that people often go to four or five grocery stores in one weekend because they're looking for a deal on this or a sale on this. Well, during the pandemic, they just wanted to go to one place and get all their groceries. And so the discounters and the lousier assortment stores, but might be cheaper, they lost out. And the companies that had grocery stores with full service, you can buy everything there. So the Safeways, the Save-Ons, the Sobeys did better, relatively speaking, during the pandemic, which I wouldn't have predicted that. Now, right now, it's kind of swinging back. I think I'm not there, but the discounters are back in business and probably on the rise. But during the pandemic, the full service grocery stores did better. The media outlets, billboards, radio stations, well, if businesses close, they're not advertising. And so those businesses are really hard hit by the recession. The packaging businesses did well because of takeout, because everybody was doing the home delivery and takeout. So all these kind of unpredictable consequences, and we're still living with them today, and they're still interesting. Save-On Foods, I think, you know, it's not public information, but I don't know what the number is, so I won't be accurate anyway, but say 8% of their sales ended up being home delivery. You know, and whereas typically in North America, it's more like 3%. But during the pandemic, people took home delivery. And so some of those trends have continued. You know, the work from home you know, the hybrid work from home now, all that stuff has sort of, some of that has accelerated the trend that was happening anyway in terms of technology. And others have kind of just reverted back to the way it was before the pandemic. And, you know, the restaurant business, all that business has been sort of severely hit. The one thing that I still am puzzled by, really puzzled by, is the shortage of labor. Like, you know, what happened? How is that possible that suddenly there's no people for anything? You know, not anything, but, you know, restaurants can't get people and businesses can't get people. Where did the people go? You know, I mean, obviously a lot's been written about this, and, you know, some of it's, you know, took early retirement. Some people decided to upgrade their skills to do other things. People took the opportunity, or people decided in some cases that, you know what, this is, the rat race wasn't worth the effort, you know, working three jobs and both parents, you know, maybe we should slow down a little bit and live on less. So whatever the reason is, there's a surprising labor market impact, which we're seeing, you know, today. And the Jim Pass Group owns a water slide park, a Great Wolf Lodge in Niagara Falls, right? And of course, you forget that, you know, they have lifeguards required by law. Well, for 2 years, there's no lifeguards trained in the world, if you will, right? So you go, okay, now we can open, but where do we get the lifeguards from? And then you got to go back and train people, and people go, well, why should I do that when I got other options, you know, with my life? So this kind of train we were on, we just got this abrupt breaks, you know, from the pandemic, which has had these interesting and sometimes positive and sometimes weird consequences, which I think we're still living with today. Like healthcare is another example.
Yeah. I was going to talk a little bit in your role in the Jimmy Passon Group. You weren't probably directly dealing with labor relations or labor unions, but in terms of your trajectory from being a labor organizer to being on the corporate side, your dealings with labor unions.
I did deal with labor unions quite a bit. I mean, the Jim Passon Group is just sort of not by definition sort of anti-union. I mean, they have union companies, they have non-union companies. They just, you know, they take what is probably the correct position, which is, you know, how do we make money, and, you know, how do we deal with it? And so you deal with whether people organize or not. And I dealt with it usually not a direct across the table bargaining, but usually to try to give advice to management about how best to approach it. You know, I used to give speeches to the management group of the whole company, and I would really emphasize that if you have trust. Like, if people trust you as a manager, then you can do anything. I mean, when I say do anything, you can accomplish stuff, because if the workers and the unions and the management, if they trust the leadership of the company and you're open and honest with them, then you can usually accommodate, you know, their wishes. If where you get a problem is if they lose trust in management, or management loses trust in the union. I took over one company where, you know, the union was always viewed as the problem. When I got there, I realized, well, yeah, the union's difficult, but boy, the management's horrible. so they kind of get what they deserve. So then fixing the management, you still had a challenging union, because the union had been conditioned by the management to not trust the company, and it was sort of understandable. And we managed to sort of mostly fix it as we went forward, as over time you can build that credibility up again. But, you know, I think, again, it's the same. If you're transparent and honest and fair, and you treat people with dignity and respect, and they believe, you know, and you're not phony about it, you know, even if you get into fights over legitimate demands for more share of the spoils, if you will, or more of the share of the profits, you can usually solve these problems, because you come at it from mutual respect.
Glenn, I want to turn now to kind of current BC politics. You're still a student and keen watcher of the political sphere. A lot of new challenges in government, but wondering if you could maybe give your assessment of, you know, what's needed out of BC politics or the government, or your assessment of the current government. I do want to move on to some of the crown corporations and those kinds of things, but your take sort of...
I'm not going to trash the current government. Is that what you're asking me to do?
No, I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking you to give your assessment.
No, the thing is, you're right, it's a different time, right? And different challenges. So I don't really, you know, we're all creatures of our history, right? We all come at these things with their own biases and your own things that happen to you. Your own, you know, it's a natural to reflect on that. But so I'm not really equipped to say how they're dealing with this stuff today very well. I think in general, it's been a solid, you know, progressive government that's not that's not beating on people or taking away rights or doing any of the horrible things that we've seen, certainly south of the border or elsewhere. So, you know, they're doing fine. You know, I think I would say if I were critical, I think some of the land-based stuff, I don't know if I like, in the sense that I don't think there's not enough, funny coming for me, but not enough process, I think, in terms of trying to affect change. In other words, there's when you declare the UNDRIP, you know, when you do the United Nations Declaration, which I have no problem with, and you announce that, you try to bring it into law, you need to bring along people with it. And again, it sounds a bit funny for me, having been unsuccessful in bringing people along to some of the stuff I was supporting, but I think I worry that there's a sense of distrust of governments, not this particular government, governments that you see Pierre Poilievre capitalize on. I remember that Pierre Poilievre is a good example because he talks about the country being broken. And I thought, boy, that's a pretty extreme thing. That's different than saying, you know, there's problems in the country and or the government's terrible. This is saying the country is broken. And, you know, I've come to view, you look at these polling and he keeps saying it, that there obviously is a big chunk of the population who feels that way. And if you were a forestry worker in British Columbia and, you know, you're closing sawmills because, and by the way, for a bunch of reasons, not most of which are not the government's fault, but, you know, you're closing your job, your livelihood is out of work, you know, you get pretty angry and blame somebody. And blaming is a, you know, a lack of trust in the government is making a decision based on the a whole bunch of factors. And I do worry that we're, certainly in rural Canada, there's an anger building that you feel. And I think if I were saying to the provincial government, you know, they have to go extra, this sounds like a very sort of liberal thing to say, but, you know, you do need to kind of get that sweet spot where you're making decisions, but you're listening to everybody at the same time. And so that means more than just listening and doing what you want to do anyway. That means actually engaging. And so the decisions that you make, even if people disagree with them, they feel a certain understanding that the government has worked hard to try to accommodate their views. And I think that's federally and provincially, I think there's a bit of, I have a bit of concern about that. I think social cohesion is a problem, right? If you start to get that, you get that kind of Trump thing you're seeing in the United States. You know, the thing to dwell in the United States, but I, you know, I go down there and you go to these towns that used to be prosperous union towns and the downtown's all boarded up and people are living in, you know, very poor environment and there's drugs and all kinds of issues around associated with it. And they're voting for Trump. And so you say, well, that's voting against their interest. How can they vote for this con man, you know, multimillionaire just wants to serve the rich? Well, it's because the current system is not working for them. Clearly not working for them. And I worry a little bit about that. We're not the same in Canada, but there's bits of that that I see sort of in Canada where people have that kind of legitimate criticism that the system isn't working for them. And so how they respond to that. And I think on the left, you know, we need to be aware of that, you know.
In BC's, you know, traditionally had a very kind of polarized context for over a century, maybe longer. But in some of the intractable issues that we see today, affordable housing, transit, climate change versus, you know, rural jobs, development, these kinds of impasses. You know, the government has made, the provincial governments put forward policies around densification on lots, like those types of things. I'm wondering, yeah, just your ideas on how to fast track affordable housing and some of your takes on some of the things the government's put forward.
Yeah, it's a different time. You know, climate change, for example, is clearly, you know, a problem of the world that needs to be addressed. And it actually wasn't even talked about when I was there, you know. So these are big, big, giant, intractable issues. I think that the government hasn't, governments generally haven't used the state enough. You know, we kind of lost our ability to intervene directly. So now it tends to be, you know, let's give money to people to do this or give nonprofits, et cetera. I prefer to see a bit more statist approach, right? Like build housing. You know, I read somewhere that, I don't know if it's true or not, but the, you know, there's obviously a huge shortage of affordable housing. But the number one waiting list is for seniors housing in British Columbia. I thought, well, my goodness, government should just go build some seniors housing, own it, build it, run it. But we don't, we seem to have lost that direct service delivery thing. And so that we're always using the private sector now for different programs, including social programs in the downtown east side and elsewhere. We're using nonprofits. And I'm not against that. You need all of the above. But I'd like to see governments actually build some things themselves and maybe run some things themselves, if nothing else, so they understand better the consequences, how hard it is to run some of these programs. If you have low barrier housing, you know, I can't think of anything more challenging than that, to actually run a low barrier housing project. And it'd be great if the government would build one and run it with their own staff and really understand the costs and what is involved in running it, so that they can better provide the resources necessary for nonprofits. And I think we kind of, for some reason, the last 20, 30 years, we've gotten away from direct government actions. So we're always trying to, it's kind of like pushing on a string, right? You're trying to give people money to do certain things rather than just doing it yourself. And, you know, obviously it's such a big problem. You need to do all of the above, but I think it'd be nice to see some more direct government action, I think.
As a minister who was responsible for BC Hydro, ICBC, the Crown Corps in particular in BC have been both a source of pride and a source of derision.
Yeah.
And when you think about coming from the business perspective as well, like what does the future for these Crown corporations look like? And
yeah, it's a really good question. I mean,
we in fact imported Hydro last year. With the drought this year, it'll be a very similar situation.
Well, I think we've lost our way a little bit here, in the sense that if the Crown Corporation is not going to be more responsive to the political needs of the people of the province, then it might as well be private. You know, I'm not saying they should privatize it. I'm saying rather reverse. So I don't see as much innovation in the Crown Corporations as could be. ICBC obviously made the big change in terms of no fault. That's benefited people, so they're on their way. Ferries obviously is a challenge for, I don't understand it, but it's really challenging. And Hydro and others are as well. But you know, I think we always have to remind ourselves, what's the purpose of these Crown Corporations, and why were they created? Sometimes I think these big crowns end up just kind of being a law unto themselves, running away. Again, back to my earlier statement, big bureaucracy, they're doing the best they can. They have a job to do. They're doing it, and they're doing it fine. But there's not a lot of innovation coming out of it, nor direction.
I'm wondering if you can speak, just we do have a provincial election coming up and a federal election. I know you don't want to wade too far into the political arena, but your sort of take on what the political party should be thinking about going into this fall and the spring?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the federally, for sure, you know, the conservative rise is really dramatic. And again, I think it comes from that dissatisfaction and disaffection of so many people, particularly in rural Canada. And I think things like the housing crisis, you know, I think people are just lashing out at the system. It doesn't work for them. And so, I mean, the trick for a progressive government, like an NDP government, would be to capitalize on that anger to drive change, as opposed to, you know, where it looks like it's going. And I mean, I think, look, it's a different time, so I'm probably the wrong guy, but I don't like, you know, identity politics can take you so far, but I'd prefer to see it get back a little bit more to a class political environment where people really are talking about how can we make a difference in people's lives in a day-to-day basis, particularly on the economic front. So I think we're going to need to spend a bit more time on rural economic development and economic development generally in a way that we haven't in the past, you know, say decade, where we've had surplus budgets and we've been working on social programs. I think we're going to have to get back into distribution and also, you know, sort of wealth distribution and also economic development. So in both cases, I mean, in BC, it'd be interesting to see what happens. Clearly, the Conservatives have a lot of momentum provincially as well. And I could see them coming second, you know, or even winning, actually, depending on how much momentum they get. I don't know about the United Party. They seem to be floundering. Which is fine with me, by the way.
And my final question is just, since you have been spending a lot of time in the States working in business, your take on the upcoming American election, which is a whole other
ballgame. Yeah, it's a good question. I am surprised that Trump is ahead of Biden. I was down there just last week and talking to people who used to work for me, and they're pretty well, most management are Republicans, right? just as a general proposition. And most of the people who worked for me were voted Republican. And most of them are not voting for Trump. I mean, they're not happy with that choice. And I don't think they're going to vote for him. They told me they weren't going to vote for him. So it appears to me he's less popular than he was 4 years ago. But that's not what the polls are reflecting. So I have to be optimistic that that's not the case. I think Biden, you know, has an image problem. And it stems probably from his age. And that's not the problem with that problem is you can't fix it. Like, you just can't fix it. This is a fact. So that's a challenge for the Democrats. But again, back to my old maxim, you don't have to be that good just to be better than the other guy. And I tend to have hope that Trump will fizzle out in that process.
Yeah. Glenn, always fascinating speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us at 312 Maine for Below the Radar.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Below the Radar is a Knowledge Democracy podcast created by SFU's VanCity Office of Community Engagement. Thanks for listening to our conversation with Glenn Clark. If you would like to support our podcast, you can donate at the link in the description below. Your generous donation will help support the podcast's activities and associated public events with SFU's VanCity Office of Community Engagement. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Below the Radar.